key question for Greece.
Should I stay in the euro or should I go?
From APM American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Adrienne Hill in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, February 16th.
Coming up, I'll talk with a top Greek government official.
GM posts a record profit.
And goats with accents.
It's all ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Fear is returning in European markets this morning. The concern is that Greece will not be able to get more bailout money and will default on its debt within a month.
The Greek government passed steep budget cuts over the weekend to get more bailout cash from the rest of Europe. A decision on that is expected within days. George Papakonstantinou is a member of the Greek cabinet. He was finance minister until last summer, and he joins us now from Athens. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what do you think is going to happen? There are so many moving parts right now.
Well, these are very tough times. We are in the fifth year of a recession. We passed a very difficult vote in Parliament last Sunday for the new program, which envisages financial help of 130 billion loan from the EU and the IMF, and at the same time, a reduction in national debt of 100 billion. We hope that once this is fully approved by our European partners, this will turn the page for Greece, and we will start slowly but surely, with a lot of pain, to go back on the path of sustainable growth.
Why do you think it would be better for Greece to stay in the euro than to leave the euro at this point? I can see why it's better for the rest of Europe if you stay in, but why Greece?
Because I think people who suggest that we step out of the euro, as if this was a simple affair, really do not quite understand the repercussions. Take, for example, a situation whereby rather than voting yes last Sunday, the Parliament voted no. This would have meant the EU stopping the current assistance program. It would have meant that there would be queues forming outside banks the next morning that would have to shut down the Greek banking system and have the army and the police to guard the banks. Greece would be an island, would not be able to buy any inputs, medicine or fuel, gas, oil, and would soon be unable to pay pensions and wages in the public sector and provide essential services, given that we're still running a primary deficit. So there is no such thing as some kind of an easy exit of the euro that solves the problems. It would be an unmitigated disaster.
But if you stay in and you're locked into the austerity that you have to do to get more bailout money, don't you have a problem with growth over the coming years? It may be 10 years before you have real good growth in Greece.
Well, this isn't just about austerity. This is a program of significant structural reforms, which we have been doing for the last 2 years. The country doesn't just have a fiscal problem. It's also got a competitiveness problem. We're not producing enough. We're not exporting enough. And the kind of structural reforms in liberalizing the business environment, making it easier to invest, reforming the state, reforming the tax system, all this will lead to a rebound in growth.
Finally, I want to ask you, are you concerned about the rhetoric that's been going on between Greece and particularly Germany? There's a lot of World War II rhetoric coming up.
Very much so. I'm concerned about the fact that in this country, many people look at our European allies with an increasing hostility. I'm also concerned by the fact that in the rest of Europe, there is a very easy characterization of Greece and the Greeks, which borders on the racist sometimes, and which does not recognize all the tremendous effort that has been done in the last 2 years. I mean, people are hurting at the moment, and this effort needs to be recognized.
George Papakonstantinou is the former finance minister of Greece. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, there's a sense the Greeks have exhausted the goodwill of other European countries. And for more on the whys of the growing mistrust, we go now to Manfred Weber. He's a German politician and a member of the European Parliament. Good morning, Mr. Weber.
Good morning.
Now, what do Germans specifically make of what's going on in Greece right now?
Well, from the German perspective, the people are angry because say thee that Greece worked not very well in the past and worked not very is not working very well currently. So they are angry. For example, Germany has not the situation that over the last 10 years there was a growth of the income of the people, for example. There was not a big growth of the income. In Greece there was a big growth of the income of the people. So they see we as German did a lot of structural reforms, of social security reforms and so on inside of Germany. And that was the reason why Germany is now economically very powerful.
And what would you like to see from the Greek people right now in response to what's happening?
Well, Europe wants to rescue Greece, but Greece must have the willingness to be rescued. That's at the moment the open question. And that's the situation inside of Greece. When we expecting in April elections in Greece, at the moment the polls are not very good for the current parties inside of Greece. So the people in Greece must recognize that there must be a change and of the behavior of the whole society. There must be a change. And when there is no willingness to do this, then there is no chance for Europe to rescue Greece at the end. And so they must show their willingness.
Now, we're seeing sort of tension between Greece and Germany right now, at least in the news media here in the U.S. We've actually seen Greeks describing Germans as Nazis in some of their protests. Is that sort of counterproductive right now?
Well, all the politicians inside of the European Union must argue at the moment very sensible, because the difference between the United States and Europe is that we are facing a big economic crisis, but we have in Europe additionally an institutional crisis. I'm as a German politician here in the European Parliament, I must convince the people that there is a need of investing from a German point of view in stability, and I expect from the Greek politicians that they must convince the people that there is not more the possibility to live like they did in the past. They must cut the debts and so on. So we need sensibility inside of the European Union.
Mr. Weber, thanks so much.
Thank you.
GM announced this morning it had a record profit last year, $7.5 billion. That's up 62% from 2010. But analysts were expecting better.
For more, we go to Michelle Krebs. She's a senior analyst at Edmunds.com. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why is GM doing so well?
Well, General Motors had a record year. They had profits of $7.6 billion. A lot of it has to do with the simple fact that the economy improved. It was a very good year for car sales, considering. So they enjoyed that boom. The other thing that benefited GM and the Big Three is the fact that Toyota and Honda kind of were out of the game last year because they had a lot of disruptions in their production because of the March earthquake.
So why are analysts disappointed by these numbers then? They look good.
Well, despite GM setting a record, it wasn't what analysts thought it would be. Analysts thought it would be $8 billion or higher. And I think what's really concerning is the trend of the fourth quarter. The fourth quarter was the lowest quarter since General Motors' IPO. There are some storm clouds on the horizon that are concerning.
Now, what's in these numbers for car buyers? Anything we can glean about this year?
Well, I don't know specifically for GM numbers, but what we expect in the United States are continued improvement in overall car sales, but we do see a much more competitive landscape this year because Toyota and Honda will be back in full force after disruptions last year from the earthquake and a lot of new product. That's going to be a very competitive segment, and when it's competitive, you may see some incentives, and that's good for consumers.
Michelle Krebs is senior analyst at Edmunds.com. Thanks.
Thank you.
American automakers have traditionally dominated the rental car market here in the U.S., but now those fleets are getting a foreign invasion. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
In the past, only about 7% of Toyotas became rental cars. Last month, that jumped to almost 20%. Toyota's trying to overcome years of problems that kept people out of its cars. First, there was this.
The car maker is voluntarily recalling more than 2 million vehicles because the accelerator can get stuck.
Then there were supply shortages after the Japanese tsunami. John Healy of North Coast Research says the company is trying to get people back into its cars.
And I think a good way to illustrate that your cars are safe, reliable, and meet the needs of Americans today is to get your cars into a rental fleet.
There are drawbacks. Former auto industry exec Peter DiLorenzo says deals with rental companies are less profitable than traditional sales.
And you run the risk of having people equate your brand with, quote unquote, just a rental car, something that they would rent but they would never buy.
He expects Toyota to downshift on the rentals when the sales kick into gear. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
And we will be speaking tomorrow with the CEO of Ford, Alan Mulally, to kick off our coverage, which begins next week in Michigan. We'll be broadcasting the show from Michigan, and we'll be talking with business leaders, government leaders, as well as voters from all walks of life.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Well, we've got some brand new and good-looking jobs news this morning. The number of people applying for unemployment benefits fell again last week. It is now near a four-year low.
But a lot of small business owners, who together are the country's biggest employer, are still wary of hanging out help wanted signs. Why? We want to know what Americans are thinking.
And the latest poll numbers suggest
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said!
It's time for our weekly attitude check. Joining us today, as he does every Thursday, is Gallup's editor-in-chief, Frank Newport. Good morning.
Good morning.
So Gallup recently polled small business owners about why they aren't hiring. What'd they tell you?
Well, I think the answer is divided into two categories, and it's very, very important to consider these. One were kind of straightforward reasons. The business conditions didn't warrant it hiring new people, or the cash flow didn't warrant it. They had no need for new people. But there was a whole second category, which was broader in scope, and that is they were worried about the overall U.S. economy. They were worried about health care. And they were worried about excessive government regulations on their business. So it's the standard reasons, and also what happens in Washington seems to be affecting small business hiring as well.
And what do we know about whether or not small businesses need more people?
You know, 42% of small businesses who were hiring said they still weren't hiring as many people as they ideally would want a year or two ago, and now that's down to 29%. So it looks like there's not quite as much pent-up demand on the part of small business owners now. You know, I need people, but I don't want to hire them, as there was a year or two ago. So that's, again, a little more progress in the correct direction.
Now, what do these numbers tell us more broadly about the jobs market here in the U.S.?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. I think I would highlight a couple of things. One is what I mentioned a moment ago, and that is we've seen a slight uptick in net hiring on the part of small business owners. These are people, by the way, in our Wells Fargo Gallup Index that have $20 million of revenues or less. So there's a small uptick there. That's good news. And the second point I would make is Washington matters. Regulations out of Washington do affect the psyche of small business owners who are looking to hire or not hire.
Very interesting. Gallup editor-in-chief Frank Newport, thanks.
You bet.
Rupert Murdoch is expected in London today, where he'll face some angry employees. Nine journalists from his UK tabloid The Sun have been arrested in the last few weeks after Murdoch's own company turned them in for alleged corruption. This is related, of course, to the allegations of phone hacking by reporters at News Corporation. Roy Greenslade is the former editor of the British tabloid The Mirror and now a professor of journalism at City University in London. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, so it sounds like this scandal involving Rupert Murdoch's publications is very different today than it was just a few months ago.
Yes, it's expanded out from his Sunday newspaper, which he had to close. And now the heat has turned on his daily newspaper, the hugely successful high-selling Sun, where there are allegations now that journalists have been for many years bribing public officials to obtain information. This has led to the arrest of nine Sun journalists, high-ranking, way up to the deputy editor level. And now Murdoch finds himself in a strange situation where one half of his company is helping the police and the other half, the Sun journalists, are extremely upset that their colleagues are being arrested on this information.
Rupert Murdoch obviously is a very powerful man all around the world. Is this scandal at this point threatening his power and his entire empire?
Well, it's quite clear that he's in a strange situation where he appears to have lost control of his own newspaper empire. His own Sun newspaper ran an article on Monday by an associate editor in which he referred to a little local difficulty, a code for saying that they were in fact under siege from their own side. So this civil war in his own company is something he needs to deal with, and it's going to be a tough ask.
Roy Greenslade is former editor of The Mirror, the British tabloid. He's also a professor of journalism. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The price of oil has stabilized some. That's after a recent run-up. Now, trying to figure out why exactly prices jump around is always a little tricky. But one obvious factor, concerns about Iran and its nuclear plans. From Washington, Scott Tong reports.
Iran yesterday showed off a new reactor and what it described as homemade uranium that's 20% pure. That's more than needed for electricity. It approaches weapons grade. And an unstable Persian Gulf spooks the price of oil up, says Anthony Cordesman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
If anyone raises world oil prices, everyone in the United States pays that price, and we're doing it today simply because of an announcement of a nuclear reactor.
Iran has been a top-shelf worry for policymakers ever since a November report from the International Atomic Energy Agency.
This basically laid out the fact that Iran now has every element of technology needed to make a fission weapon. It doesn't mean it has a weapon.
Or even actively building one. Still, the EU and the U.S. have fast-tracked sanctions, and the Europeans are phasing in an Iran oil boycott, which Iran countered yesterday, suggesting it would stop selling right now. It backtracked, but oil still went up. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
If you're a fan of Snickers or Twix and you like to get the big king-size candy bars, you'd better stock up now, because by the end of next year, the Mars company that makes them will stop selling all of its chocolate products with more than 250 calories. The king size is 540. It is part of a push for, quote, responsible snacking. But of course, Adrian, if you are still feeling a little irresponsible,
which sometimes I do,
you could always go and get two Snickers bars, or maybe four of the miniature ones.
Still a lot of Snickers. If you walk past the building that used to be a Borders bookstore in downtown Chicago, today you'll find an art exhibit in its windows. That's one way of filling the space that was emptied after Borders closed down all 399 of its locations last year. The question of what would become of these huge big box stores puzzled commercial real estate experts. And now, as David Weinberg reports, they're getting some answers.
Nearly 5 years before Borders announced it was closing, Rodney Spriggs already had his eye on several Borders locations.
We are very interested in the space as if something would ever happen on Borders.
Spriggs is CEO of the retail chain VStock, which sells new and used books, video games, and DVDs. This fall, when Borders went under, VStock snapped up three of its former locations in St. Louis.
We actually had the deals done before Borders had even ceased operations.
It was a very fast turnaround.
That swift action was perfect for Kenya Barber. She was a manager at Borders for 13 years.
It was actually pretty wonderful. They kind of rode in like shining knights.
VStock offered her a job at the new store, and Barber is now a manager there. She says this economy is perfect for customers looking to buy used. And for people who need a little extra cash, they can sell their old movies and video games for cash. Barber says the most popular items people bring in are books.
We had, I believe, over 500 by noon.
Today, you know,
today. 500.
VStock isn't the only company moving into former Borders locations. National chains like REI, Forever 21, and the arts and crafts store Michaels are all making plans to lease former Borders properties.
The overall recovery in retail sales over the past 18 months has been strong enough to cause a resurgence in demand for brick and mortar retail space.
Hassam Naji is the managing director at Marcus & Millichap, the nation's largest investment brokerage. He says the retail market is rebounding surprisingly fast.
Net demand for retail space across the U.S. has been positive for the past seven consecutive quarters.
But, Naji says, many of the Borders properties located in the outer suburbs may have permanently lost their value and could remain empty for the foreseeable future. In St. Louis, I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
In its filing with the government announcing it was going public, Facebook said it had a problem with its mobile business. It hasn't found a way to make money with its mobile applications and its mobile users. Well, a French wireless company says it may have found one way to help Facebook out.
Find new users in Africa. The company, called Orange, is introducing a technology that will allow African customers to access Facebook without an iPhone or other expensive smartphone. For more, we're joined by the BBC's technology correspondent, Mark Gregory, for our Midday Extra. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
So how does this technology actually work?
Well, in technology terms, it's nothing special at all. It's exactly the same technology that African cell phone users already use to keep in touch with their mobile service provider. It's the technology that they access their mobile bills from, for making payments, for topping up their credits, all that kind of stuff. The acronym for it is USSD. So it's nothing to do with it being new technology. It's just old technology that's being used in a new way, so that people can access Facebook in kind of cut down form. So Facebook will appear a bit like text messages.
And why does it make sense for Orange to invest in Facebook this way?
Well, because they reckon that there is an enormous untapped desire among African customers to do social networking. And the problem that they face is that they don't tend to have smartphones. Internet connections when they're there are not very reliable. So a lot of African markets are completely outside the Facebook revolution. If you can make the technology available through conventional old-style cell phones, then potentially you can draw in millions of extra people. And we're talking about 70 million people across Africa who have old-style cell phones who can now access Facebook for the first time.
Is Facebook not very big in Africa? What do we know about Facebook's profile on the continent?
Well, it is taking off in some places. For example, it's quite popular in Egypt and some of the more developed markets. And of course, it is popular among smartphone users. In African cities, there are a lot of people who use smartphones. But as a proportion of the total population, that tends to be very small. So this is about bringing new segments of the population into using Facebook. They're already used to fiddling with their mobile phones. Mobile phones have brought about a social revolution in many parts of Africa. And if you like, this is the next step.
Now, could this be a big income generator for Facebook?
Well, interestingly, there will be a charge for accessing this cut-down form of Facebook. Actually, Facebook doesn't get the revenues. It's the mobile service provider, the French company Orange, that does that. But unlike almost anywhere else in the world, you will be paying to use Facebook. I suppose for Facebook, the revenues come if it can start selling advertising to African consumers. I mean, it's beginning to do quite well in many other parts of the world with this, so why not Africa? After all, incomes are rising very sharply in many African economies, and there's a lot of growth that there hasn't been in many recent years. So actually, this is, for the first time in history, perhaps, a very promising potential market.
Mark, I have to say, I it's hard for me to remember back enough years ago to the point when we weren't all wasting so many hours a day on Facebook and Twitter. I wonder, do you think that there's going to be a lot more time spent online doing things that don't necessarily need to be done in Africa now?
Well, I guess people have always had ways of spending their leisure time and mixing with their friends and stuff like that. So maybe it's things that people have always done. So maybe it's just the same things taking place in a new way.
The BBC's technology correspondent, Mark Gregory, thanks.
Thank you.
And finally, Jeremy, goats. Researchers,
goats.
Yes, goats. Researchers have figured out that goats can develop individual goaty accents. And those accents change once they start hanging out with other goats. I can't tell exactly what kind of accent these goats have. I was thinking maybe Midwestern. Do you have a sense?
I can't tell.
There's no word yet on how farmers could profit from different goat accents. But goats are now part of a limited group of animals known to pick up accents, including elephants, dolphins, and of course, people.
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.